And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'd like to welcome Darren Wong to the program today. Darren is the founding executive director of the AJC Decatur Book Festival. As a public radio producer, he produced or hosted several series, including The Spoken Word, Porches, the South and Her Writers, and Atlanta Forum. His writing has appeared in Paste Magazine, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, The Supporter Report, and others. Today we'll be talking about his debut novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, which is available from Thomas Dunn Books. The Hidden Light of Northern Fires opens with a prologue where you write about your family moving into an old barn outside of Buffalo, New York. Is this true or was an authorial sleight of hand?
No, that's all true. This is the house I grew up in. It was a converted barn 15 miles outside of Buffalo in Townline, New York. It had been an Underground Railroad stop back in 1859, 1860 or so.
Now, how many events in the book are factual?
They intermingle pretty well, but I've come to say all the weird stuff is true. Right? Townline, New York, in fact, did secede from the Union. There was an Underground Railroad station in this house. There was a plot on the Canadian border led by a Memphis's own Jacob Thompson to go to Johnson's Island in Lake Erie, free several thousand Confederate soldiers and arm them and turn them loose onto downtown Buffalo in October or November of 1864. And Abraham Lincoln did in fact pass through the farm I grew up on, although I didn't know this growing up. So yeah, all the weird stuff is true.
So Millard Fillmore was recruiting for the Union?
Yeah, Millard Fillmore, is from upstate New York, or right there. His law offices were in East Aurora, which are 5 miles, 10 miles from town line. And he signed the Fugitive Slave Law, of course, which was probably part of the start of the Civil War legislatively 10 years before. But he definitely was for fighting for the preservation of the Union.
Now, the book proper begins with a notice in a newspaper about the reward for a man who escaped slavery by the name of Joe Bell. He fled Harper's Ferry in Virginia, and it seems he made it a long way before the start of the book.
Well, I will own up to fabricating Joe Bell wholly as a kind of an amalgamation of the idea of a runaway slave, but then a whole lot of texture added in. Hopefully, Harper's Ferry, that was Virginia at the time, it was before it split, is on the very north end of Virginia. So it was basically crossing Pennsylvania in a diagonal to get there.
A former slave with no money and the Fugitive Slave Law against him. I mean, he made it quite a way.
Yeah. I mean, the Underground Railroad was an effective tool for getting folks moved along. I don't explain how he finds himself into that network. That might be a little bit of an artistic conceit. But for the Underground Railroad to be effective, you had to cross that territory. Because of the Fugitive Slave Law, it wasn't worthwhile to just get to a northern state, a free state. You had to get over to Canada.
And so Townline was probably about 15, 20 miles from the Canadian border, a good place to get off at because there were so many bounty hunters looking for runaway slaves at the border. That would be kind of an early bailing out point to kind of sneak from there.
Yeah, that's how I set it up, and it certainly makes sense. As the closer you get to the border, you would expect to see. Part of the issue with the Fugitive Slave Law was that if you were a bounty hunter, you could essentially pluck any black man or woman off of the streets of a northern city and bring them back south. You know, identification could be challenging. You had to have your papers. If you were a freedman, you had to have your papers with you at all the time and try and establish that. It was a very precarious situation for any black folks in that area.
How had the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 changed the Fugitive Slave Law from the 1790s?
So the pivotal part of that was that it opened up the homes and properties in the North so that they were subject to search basically at the drop of a hat. It would require a marshal or a sheriff to be involved. But you didn't even have to have a reasonable suspicion. You basically had to say, oh, I think my slave or this runaway is in that house. You know, you'd be open to search and seizure in that case. You know, when folks talk about the Civil War having to do with states' rights, it's an interesting turn because, of course, this is as much of a violation of states' rights and personal property rights as can be imagined in the service of slavery for the southern side being exacted on the north. So that was part of the pivot of the Fugitive Slave Law. And also the consequences were really given teeth, up to a year in prison and $10,000 fine. $10,000 is a whopper.
And so Joe Bell had thought Townline would be a good place to bail out at before the border, but they had a couple of bounty hunters there in the area, Wilhelm and Harry, and they're not exactly the nicest guys in town.
So Harry is a fairly young guy. As the book opens, he's in his teens. He says, even in the opening pages, he's never seen a black man. He's, of course, motivated by money, but he only knows what's been told to him. He's an interesting character because he's set up as having this kind of hatred toward blacks, and he's a bounty hunter. There's nothing worse, right? But he has no personal experience to base it on, and his trajectory in the book is kind of a fun process, I think, toward, I would say, kind of an odd type of an enlightenment.
And there are a lot of parallels in the book, and we'll get to some of these parallels further in the conversation, but his parallel with Joe Bell is that Harry was an orphan, and he was supposed to go to Cleveland, but he escaped that fate and made his way on his own.
Yeah, you point out something I hadn't even thought of it in that context, but that's true. It's a lot of this book is, I think at the heart of it is this question of what is freedom and who is actually free, and is it something that we really want? Are we ready to pay the price for freedom? And it's not necessarily in the context of political freedom, but what we want as individuals, what we want to be free to do.
Now, Wilhelm was one of many German immigrants who had settled in the area, and they didn't do the best job of integrating into the local community.
You know, as I was researching this book, or as the question about town line would always come up, why would a place 15 miles from the Canadian border secede from the Union? As I started doing research, you know, there's really very little documentation from the 1861 secession. There's an order that was signed, and it has disappeared. I suspect it's hanging on somebody's basement wall somewhere in downtown New York, but they've never brought it out. So people would always ask, what would drive this town? And it was only when I started researching, you know, looking at the immigrants that had come and settled around town line. When I grew up there, and still to this day, almost all the names are German. There's a good smattering of Polish in there now as well. But looking at a map from 1865 that has all the family names, it's largely German. So I asked myself, what would have had hundreds of Germans, you know, leaving their home and coming to America? And found out that there was this whole wave from 1848 revolutions in Europe that were violent, and, you know, the conscription.
That was the new wine into old bottles.
Yeah.
Revolution.
Yeah, exactly. So that had these folks fleeing. You know, they come to America and find a plot of land. You can imagine them wanting nothing more than to plow their fields, raise their family, and be left alone, pay their taxes. And suddenly there's all this talk of revolution and war and civil war and everything that had to have some pretty disturbing echoes for them.
So they weren't necessarily sympathetic to the Confederate cause. They just didn't want to be dragged into that.
Yeah, for me, that's the crux of it. In the press around the town line secession, because it rejoined the Union only in 1946, in a kind of a big publicity stunt. Around that happening, there was a lot of talk of alignment with the Confederacy and so on. But I've seen no evidence of it. You know, I can find the military records of a dozen kids or a dozen men from around town line and Alden and that area for Union soldiers. The people in the town line that talk about Confederacy alignment say that they sent several boys down south to fight in the Confederacy, but there's no records, there's no specific names, there's nothing to make that not look like a kind of a wives' tale.
But there were Confederate sympathizers up north known as Copperheads.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. There was a lot of motivation toward not wanting a war and the idea that they had the right to have slaves, all that. It's kind of an interesting conversation when we think about blue states and red states and everything currently. You know, we think of, you know, New York State as being monochromatically liberal. And we know that's not the case, you know.
Population centers are blue.
Yeah, well, even Buffalo is reddish purple. I mean, it depends on where it would go, right? And then there are certainly pockets even within the city. You know, I think what's interesting for me as I did the research in this book and kind of explored these ideas is when we think of our current political climate, I live in a very blue dot, Decatur, Georgia, in a very red state. That feels relevant to me somehow, and the idea of a, you know, pockets of resistance around, of Confederate sympathizers and so on here and there throughout the state, throughout New York, even though everyone thinks, you know, in fact, there was a strong push during the Civil War for New York City to secede from the state and align itself with the Confederacy in some ways, because so much of its economy was based on Southern cotton.
Harry can't see the irony of his wanting his sense of freedom to be impinged on to deprive Joe Bell of his freedom. And when Joe defends himself against Harry's dog who attacks him out in the countryside, and he gets this absurd sense of revenge for hurting someone when he was trying to deprive him of his freedom.
I mean, doesn't that feel, I mean, that's absolutely true, but it's, you know, if somebody hurts your dog, if you love your dog and you grow up with this animal as your lifelong companion, essentially, it hurts the dog, then all other motivation for some people, you can picture it going away, you know, just that idea of revenge. The guy killed my dog. Kind of one of the ideas that I was aiming for in this book is that these things drive on, these hatreds or these things, they drive on personal things much more than ideologically. Harry hears from Wilhelm and some other people that, you know, blacks are bad and they're evil and they're subhuman, all these terrible things as he's growing up, and he believes it. And then one shows up and kills his dog. You know, the idea that he would seek revenge, you know, seems it would be the only reaction he would have. Then I think over the course of the book, we start teasing out who he is and what he learns over time.
In this incident, Joe Bell also grievously injures Wilhelm, and just in defending himself, but he's been injured himself and his wounds get infected. He's delirious, but he accidentally finds his way to where he was supposed to go.
Yeah. He's kind of stumbles in the dark. It's one of the moments of kismet, right? That he would end up where he needed to be at that point with Mary Willis. He stumbles into my house, essentially.
And Mary Willis is a young woman. Her father owns a farm and a lot of property that is harvested for lumber. And I think over the course of the book, she's the character that comes to the fore the most. We get to see a lot of other characters, inner selves, and perspectives. But I think it's Mary that we tend to identify with most in the book.
Yeah, it's funny. I got a call this morning from a friend of mine who just finished the book and said, "Oh, this is my favorite character." Actually, he said Harry was his favorite character, right? And you know, I did a reading last night, and somebody was saying how much they loved Mary. Me, I'm particular to Leander, which many people kind of see as a ne'er-do-well. It's nice to see how that's kind of spread out and how the characters seem to each stand up on their own.
Yeah, I think we kind of spend the most time with Mary.
Yeah, Mary is definitely the spine of the book. She is the trajectory of the book. And she's based on this real character, Mary Willis, who went to Alfred University, which is only the second college in the country to accept women, about 60 miles southeast of town line. You know, she's documented as being part of the Underground Railroad. It's a wildly radical thing for a woman to be doing, a young woman, 23 years old. The idea to be, you know, risking everything, you know, the family's farm and everything for the sake of helping runaway through her barn. So the idea of kind of the strength of her character that I think shows up in the course of the book, I think is inevitable given that just what we know about her biography.
Well, and her seeking out higher education and taking these socially forward stances is not going to make her popular with the local community.
Yeah, certainly. You know, she pays the price for her idealism. That schism between where she lives, a place that her father essentially founded, and you know, is pretty deep because a place that's grown up around her father's work is not sympathetic to who she is.
At the beginning, she is looking for some way out of town line. She wants to experience more of the world. And that's something that many of the adult children characters in this book all seem to want to leave home. Her brother Leander wants to leave home. Yates, who's the son of the slave owner back in Virginia, wants to leave home. Joe and his sister Alara, who are enslaved, want to leave where they're from. Harry, of course, left where he was supposed to go to. It seems like leaving home is a big common theme for all these characters.
I think that's true. And what, you know, in the research that I was doing on this, I ended up doing a bunch of research back in New York and railroads and all this stuff. Doesn't play too large a part in the book. It shows up in bits and pieces. But, you know, a name that comes up constantly in that context is Horace Greeley. Every time I'd see it, you know, the same phrase would come to mind, which is, "Go West, young man." Part of the issue that really drove the Civil War was questions about the Western states or Western territories that were turning into states. Kansas is the perfect example. The whole kind of battles around Kansas were about which states were going to be free and which were going to be slave states. And if enough of the territories turned into free states, then slavery would be abolished through conventional means. What that tells me, though, and what interests me about that is this idea that there is this westward urge that, I mean, was in its heyday at this point. The California Gold Rush was 1849, of course, but that whole sense of opportunity being West. You know, I saw a lot of Willis family people moving West in the records as well. We don't think about it in the context of the Civil War. We think everybody is focused on North versus South. You also think about, even now we're faced with political climate right now. There's an urge for, you know, many of us feel like, where can I go to be away from this? You know, where can you start new when things feel like they're falling apart, or when you want to set out on your own, when you're unhappy with the way things are? Then there's this big looming opportunity that just seems like essentially the definition of freedom.
Well, how did you find your way from upstate New York down to Atlanta?
Bad directions, I think. No, I graduated from Cornell and I didn't have a job lined up or anything like that. I'd had enough of those cold Buffalo winters, Ithaca winters, and my parents had moved south, so they moved to Florida. I kind of half followed them down to Atlanta.
You mentioned that some people think Leander, Mary's younger brother, is a ne'er-do-well. He's a great baseball player in the very early days of the game, but he's more of a good-time Charlie than anything else.
Yeah. Leander's an 18-year-old kid, right? We were chatting before we started recording about our college days. I don't know what you were like when you were a freshman in college, but, you know, I think of all of the bad decisions I made when I was...
I had a mullet.
There you go, right? I mean, I remember registering for classes. You know, this is the day there was no online. You had to go stand in line. And, you know, all the serious kids would get up and go and get in line to register for the best class. They'd have to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I'd show up at 10:30 and I'd get the leftovers, right? And
was Carl Sagan at Cornell then?
He was at Cornell. And if I had shown up at 6 o'clock, I might have gotten into one of his classes. You know, that seems like a silly detail, right? But, you know, I had great classes. I mean, it was a good school. But if I had the determination at age 18 to focus on what I wanted to do and get up out of bed and go register for the classes that I want and show up at 9 o'clock for, you know, and take classes not based on what fit into my schedule, but what really drove me, who knows what opportunities would have presented themselves. This is just a perfect example. At 18, you do what's most convenient, right? That's what Leander does. His are on a stage so that they have much worse consequences than getting in the wrong English class.
Now, there is a neighbor named Charles who is a farmer, and he is definitely not a good time Charlie.
You know, I really love Charles. He's based on a real character, real person, who's named John Webster. He's a serious, quiet kind of outdoorsman. He loves the woods, loves being out. He oddly loves where he is and is forced to leave. He becomes an exile, in essence. So there's another question about freedom there. So he's free to go anywhere, essentially, but where he wants to be. It ends up kind of becoming a proxy for a lot of different things, but we get to see the West through his eyes, at least. I really enjoyed writing that character. He's a lot of fun, and it also ends up speaking of the idea of what the freedom is, what the fantasy of freedom really brings you.
Now, a character who parallels Leander is Yates Bell, who's the son of the plantation owner where Joe had absconded from. But he has a meaner edge to him than Leander could ever hope to have.
John Yates Bell is his full name, and he's based on a real character named John Yates Beall, B-E-A-L-L, I believe is how it's spelled. And he, his trajectory, this is all true, right? His family had a big plantation right next to Charles Washington's plantation, and Charles Washington being the younger brother of George Washington, that kind of wealth. He joined the Botts Grays when John Brown raided Harper's Ferry Armory. They rallied and laid siege to the armory, and he was there standing a few people over from John Wilkes Booth when they hanged John Brown. That's a lot of Johns in one space, by the way. But they corresponded pre-war, John Yates Beall and John Wilkes Booth. They were friends. And there's all kinds of conspiracy theories attached to that. So John Yates Beall ends up conscripted because he's part of the militia, and ends up kind of going off the rails during the war and being recruited. He ends up in Canada, as a lot of dicey Confederate people did. Memphis's own Jacob Thompson assigns him to run a raid on Johnson's Island. He took over a boat called the Philo Parsons. There was eventually a mutiny, but this is all true. And I find this, he was supposed to send these Confederates into the Buffalo downtown to open a northern front in the Civil War.
And so we have agent provocateur in an upstate New York named Compson in the book. And how much had you known before your research about this northern front in the Civil War?
Nothing. So this is one of those moments that was really striking to me. It's because I had written a decent amount of the book. I was feeling a little bit frustrated with a few plot points and what was going on. It didn't feel like it was standing up on its own. That whole time, I kept focusing on the South for the Civil War, which is what you would logically do. And I took a long drive. I was actually driving up to Buffalo. And the whole time, what was happening on the Canadian front? What was Canada doing? So I started doing some research on that, and it was astounding. You know, none of this stuff, nobody really talks about this stuff. I find journal entries of Jefferson Davis, this is post-war, writing about looking at the Buffalo waterfront from Fort Erie, and, you know, after he'd escaped up there, and all this preponderance of Confederates wandering around Canada at various stages. I knew none of it, but there were, you know, a lot of raids and a lot of just nefarious stuff going on there.
And so you have several characters who are motivated by freedom, and then one by revenge. And then you have the backdrop of the Civil War, but not much of the war proper going on. It's an unusual staging for that time in America.
Yeah, I set myself out as a goal here to not write a battle scene. I don't have anything to add to that particular conversation. This is a book of home fronts, essentially, all types of home fronts. And what interests me are the currents and eddies at the edge of the larger river that tell stories. You know, part of it is, you know, we know the great moments of triumph or the great moments of failure. The choice to do Pickett's Charge in Gettysburg, you know, has been analyzed for 150 years. What's interesting to me is these stories that talk about our humanity that are happening offstage, in essence, from that. There's one chapter in this book that I titled Gettysburg. Other than a reference to the trouble down in Pennsylvania, there's no mention of Gettysburg at all. But it's happening at the exact same time. There was essentially a race riot in Buffalo, New York, on the same days as Gettysburg was happening.
No, I don't know if race riot is quite the right word.
Yeah, well,
it's a massacre of African Americans by Irish Americans.
Yeah, it's an anti-race. But all this stuff is going on, and it gets overshadowed by this. You know, this is a Buffalonian talking about it. We're used to always getting overshadowed.
You mentioned the title chapter, Gettysburg. The titles of the chapters are often a person's name, a season of the year, a location, an event, but there doesn't seem to kind of like be any unifying theme. I was just wondering how you went about naming all those chapters and what the idea was behind naming them that way.
I had fun with them. Sometimes there's a little bit of irony in the titles or something like that, but you're right, there was never kind of a unifying sensibility, whereas this one has to say this or something. So there's some echoes. There's one chapter's called Blue and one's called Gray, but they're not necessarily what you'd think they were about. I was indulging a little bit, to tell you the truth. I was having fun with them.
There's another common theme that ties many of the characters together, and that's not having maternal figures in their lives. John and Allura's mother had been sold to a plantation in Louisiana. Yates's mother had gone back to Ireland because she was viciously mad at her husband. And Mary and Leander's mother had died when they were young.
Yeah, there's a conceit in there, and that oftentimes, I guess I think of the mother figure as being the source of comfort. Right? That's not always the case, but that's how I would tend to write it.
Not with that new Aronofsky movie.
Yeah. no, not it. that would be my instinct to write it that way. And for these characters to be less comfortable, for them to be pushed out into the world in one way or the other, to not have that comfort, seemed important to me. In particular, Mary Willis, historically, her mother passed away many years after the war. But I wanted to talk about the sense of isolation that I imagined this woman having, and I thought it was a lot easier to do that if she didn't have the comfort of her mother.
Mary and Allura have a parallel, and they're both educated, Mary beyond what is thought proper, and Allura what is considered legal. But they are both women who have more education than is normal.
Yeah. One of the challenges with writing the story of a runaway slave, and Allura is Joe's sister, but one of the challenges is, especially if you're not African-American yourself or not black, is to try and write in that dialect without opening yourself up to a lot of very fair criticism. It was actually something of a cheat in the earliest days. It took me a long time to write this book, but one of the earliest days, I said, I have to have my runaways as, you know, educated, because I'm not going to try and get that slave pigeon downright. That was kind of one of the earliest ideas of it, but it opened up so many possibilities about who these people were and what their observations and their voices could be and what would drive them forward. Allura has a difficult path, but there are moments of brilliance and rebellion on her part. They don't always lead well to where we would like them to go. And I think that was at the heart of her kind of education, and her intellect is what helped drive that.
Now, with so many of these characters having parallels to each other, was there any sense of trying to highlight what choices can make a difference in a life, or were you just trying to show vagaries and vicissitudes that face us in life?
I mean, you talked about Yates and Leander, the sons of these two different families, and the choices they make, right? So both make bad choices early on, do terrible things, and they're both given opportunity for redemption. One lets his hatred, his anger, drive him in one direction. The other lets his compassion drive him in the other.
Now, you said it took a long time to write this book, and you had these stories in your head for quite some time. Were there any other stories keeping them company that might find their way to the page anytime soon?
You know, the thing about Western New York, it is so rife with history. I would argue that it was the most radical place in the world in the first half of the 19th century. And the stories that come out of it that nobody talks about are astounding to me.
Was Oneida over there?
Yeah, Oneida's not too far from there, but Mormonism comes out of Western New York, Palmyra, New York, in that era. There's a very important book called The Burned Over District that's kind of examination of radical religions in the early 19th century in that area in Western New York. You crossed over the creek in my backyard and you'd be at Buffalo Creek Indian Reservation that had the Seneca sold to a group called the Community of True Inspiration, also known as the Ebenezers. They make an appearance in the book. But the Ebenezers moved west to found the Amana colonies in Iowa. It's kind of this Shaker movement type thing, simplicity. And Seventh-day Adventism started in Western New York after the Great Disappointment in 1848, when they expect the world to end and they wake up and it's still there. Frederick Douglass is based out of Rochester, New York. He's the root of abolitionism and the beginnings of the civil rights movement is there.
And wasn't Susan B. Anthony from the Rochester area, too?
Yes, she was. And she's buried in Rochester, but she wasn't at the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. But, you know, she and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who organized that meeting, became lifelong friends soon afterward. That's the beginning of feminism. If you were to draw that point on a map, that would be Seneca Falls. All that's happening in Western New York this time. One of my favorite stories is Manuel Mordecai Noah, who decided to found the modern state of Israel in Western New York in the 1830s and came west.
Way before Herzl.
exactly, right? And he came west and bought Grand Island, New York, which is in the Niagara-Buffalo River between Canada and the U.S., and came west to Buffalo to lay the cornerstone of the modern state of Israel. You can go see the cornerstone in the Buffalo Museum. He called it Ararat, which speaks of the ego involved for a guy named Noah. But nobody showed up, but that's an amazing story. So I just need the time. I've got all kinds of stuff.
Now, you're the co-founder and executive director for the Decatur Book Festival for, 12 years or so?
Yeah.
How does it feel now not to spend 6 months of the year freaking out?
I'm still trying to pay the bills for this one, so I'm still freaking out. Working on the festival was a great, great privilege, becoming part of a larger community through that. But it's surprising how many ways it takes over your brain, over your mindset. So everything seems like a challenge or an opportunity that needs to be explored for the festival. And now to have that gone feels kind of interesting and odd. And I guess that's my quest for freedom.
But why did y'all decide to do the same weekend as Dragon Con in Atlanta?
that actually turns out to be a really good choice, to tell you the truth, because I don't think they really compete, except maybe for a couple of hotel rooms. But we share some authors, typically. Atlanta is kind of crazy that weekend. I'm going to do a Chamber of Commerce pitch.
Okay? And you got the Chick-fil-A kickoff football games.
Exactly, right? So there's a college football game that weekend. There's also Black Gay Pride in town that weekend. There's Dragon Con, which is the big kind of pop culture mecca.
Sci-fi fantasy.
And then there's the book festival. What we found is a lot of families come, and to fall into typical gender stereotypes, dad goes to the football game, mom comes to the book festival, and the kids go to Dragon Con. And then mom goes to Dragon Con and dad goes to the book festival too. It all kind of intertwines, but just the football game was happening. You know, one family member might not be able to convince the others to go.
Well, Darren, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your book with
this
us.
This has been delightful. Thank you so much, man.
Darren Wong is the author of The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, which is available from Thomas Dunn Books. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at wiplfm@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WYPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.